Good evening.
Bill.
Yeah.
Brent Kelly.
Yes, sir.
How are you?
Let me look at my watch.
Okay.
My goodness, you're certainly punctual.
That is one of the few good characteristics that I have.
Well, that's fine. That's fine. Well.
Well, I could tell.
I'm sorry. Me,
pardon me?
I say I have in front of me.
Uh-huh.
Your questions.
Okay.
Would you like to start at one and go through them?
Yes, I would very much. Let me say one thing before we start.
Yeah.
I'm taping you. Okay.
Yeah, that's all right.
The tape machine will stop in about 10 minutes. I will have to call it several names and get it started. Once I start it the second time, it'll work just fine, but we'll have to stop at one point. It does this.
I don't make a difference.
It's a very frustrating machine. I don't know how to fix it, but I do know that if I think bad thoughts about it, it gets back going again.
Well, you can just let me know when to stop or a little ahead of time, and
I don't know when it'll do it. It does it on its own volition.
Yeah. But I might not know when it's doing it, so you'll have to let me know when it's doing it.
Yes, sir, I will. Sometimes it makes a noise and sometimes it doesn't, so we'll just have to see what happens.
Yeah, all right.
But if you would please just go ahead and, read the question and tell me your answer, and then I may ask more about it or add something to it, if that's all right.
Yeah, you go. We'll just go right through and take our time and stop me anytime you want to.
Okay, great.
Yeah. Well, question number one has to do with All-American basketball at Duke.
Yes, sir.
Duke's first. Was there any temptation to play pro basketball? Is your machine running?
Yes, sir, it's going. I'll holler when it stops.
Oh, okay. No, there was no temptation to play pro basketball. In 1930, when I graduated at Duke, pro basketball did not have the same stature that pro baseball had, nor
yes,
did it pay the same money, and it didn't have the same organization. So I was not inclined to go into basketball at all.
Now, tell me if I'm wrong, because I don't know that much about professional basketball. Wasn't it very loose-knit and sort of an industrial-type thing, and YMCA-type thing?
Yes, it was. As a matter of fact, George Marshall, who owned the Palace Laundry in Washington, D.C., had most of the original Celtics there in Washington playing for him. He had Dutch Dehnert and Pete Barry,
mm-hmm,
and Horace Haggerty and Nat Holman. He had those people there.
Okay, we're going. I'm sorry. Very, very sorry. Go ahead.
All right. You don't need to apologize. And I was playing basketball at Tech High School at the time, and we used to go up to the arcade and scrimmage against those players. But George Marshall, who later owned the Redskins, had a team. But they were more or less a freelance organization that scheduled contests here, there, and elsewhere. And it really wasn't as complete a league as it later developed into.
And you, in high school, you scrimmaged against that quality of player?
Oh, yes.
My goodness.
Yeah, they had a big net that fastened down into the floor, and those players used to toss us into the nets like beanbags. And they taught us a great deal about how basketball should be played.
Well, I bet they did.
They taught us just about every dirty trick in the book, holding onto your pants and holding onto your belt and locking their elbows over your arm. And if there was a trick in basketball, when I went to Duke University, I knew it because I'd played against those many of the original Celtics that played up in New York. Of course, they were much larger. They were much heavier, and they were much more experienced than we were.
Certainly.
But it was good training for us.
I bet it was.
Yeah.
Quite an experience.
And then at your number two question, did you complete law school? No, I did not. When I got through with my first year of baseball, I entered Georgetown Law School. And I had a year of law school and did very well. During the latter part of my law school year, the Yankees came to me and asked me whether I intended to continue with law school or whether I was going to play ball. I had no money. I had a wife. I'd been married back in September of 1929. I had a little boy that was born on January the 8th of 1931. And I had to have the money to feed these people, so I told the Yankees I was going to play ball.
Mm-hmm.
I was reasonably successful in baseball, and it took me a long time before I was able to work myself out of it. But I always worked toward getting out of baseball. I really never did work to stay in it. And ultimately, I was able to get out of baseball, but it did take me about 12 years to do it.
That was a very good 12 years.
Yeah, it took me 12 years to do it.
Well,
I was reasonably successful and did command one of the higher salaries. And in those days, there was a big depression in 1929, 30, 31, and I was making as much or more than college presidents, and it was hard to turn your back on that kind of money.
How much money were you making?
$12,500.
Oh, that was outstanding at that time.
It was. It was a lot of money.
Well, let me ask you this question, interject a thought that I had on another list of questions I had that I didn't include in there. You were a leader, a team leader, wherever you were. Did you ever consider going into managing?
No, I was working all the time to get out of baseball. I wasn't interested in staying in it. I enjoyed it. I had a good time. I liked the players. It was a lot of fun. But I was more family-oriented. And more, I didn't like to travel. I didn't like moving the children from school to school.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to establish roots for the kids in school. And I just didn't like moving around.
Well, everybody has to have priorities. And you've got to get that set in your own mind. Now, it sounds like you had the right priorities.
Yeah, and I was interested in getting into business and baseball was a game to me. I enjoyed it. I had fun with it. And I was happy to move on to something else.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't make a big fuss about leaving it or call a press conference or anything. I just cleaned out my locker and went on home.
Well, good for you.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah. Question number three. Paul Critchell signed you after graduation. For how much money did you receive? It was a rather peculiar arrangement. Actually, I never signed anything with the Yankees. I talked with Paul Critchell. I had no money. The Yankees agreed to finance my sophomore, junior, and senior years. They agreed to pay me a bonus at the time. They agreed to pay me a bonus at the time that I actually did sign a contract. The man laid it out orally for me. I told him that the offer sounded good to me. I told him that I would go along on that basis. basis, and that after graduation, I would sign a contract, and that I would agree to play with the Yankees, and that the terms and conditions were satisfactory to me. I looked him in the eye, he looked me in the eye, we shook hands, and that's all there was ever to it.
Very good.
There was nothing ever signed. I believed the man, and the man believed me. About 3 or 4 days after all of this happened, my father was approached by Arthur Devlin, with whom he had played in the Washington area. And Arthur Devlin was scouting for the Giants, and he offered twice as much money as the Yankees had offered. And I told my dad that I had agreed to go with the Yankees.
Mm-hmm.
And how much money they were going to offer. And he said, how much they did offer. And my dad said, well, if that's it, he said, you agreed to do that, then that ends it.
Right.
And that's the way my dad was accustomed to doing business, and that's the way I've always been accustomed to doing business. If I tell you I'm going to do something, that ends it.
That is the way it should be done, yet today these guys want to renegotiate a week after they sign a contract.
I don't believe in that. I think it's pathetic.
It's terrible.
So the whole package amounted to about $10,000. That's what it amounted to.
Now, we're talking in 1927, 28.
At the time all of this conversation was taking place, it was in the spring of 1927.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's just, how do you extrapolate over 65 years?
Well,
but it's a lot of...
It was enough money to guarantee that I could, plus what Duke was providing me, I was doing some work, I had some jobs at Duke that took care of a lot of things for me, and this enabled me to get through college and not worry financially. And enabled me at the end of my junior year to get married, which I did. And I'm still married to the same young lady. It'll be 65 years this coming September the 16th.
Wow, congratulations.
Thank you, sir. And so everything's worked out nicely.
It sounds like it.
Yeah. Now,
one, before we go on, leave Paul Critchell. He was quoted as saying you had the best baseball legs he ever saw, including Cobb.
Well, I could run. I could run. I should have done a lot better in baseball than I did. Actually, in 1934, I kicked a water bucket and broke my big toe. And I didn't know that I'd broken it. I played the last 2 weeks of the season with a broken great toe on my right foot.
Uh-huh.
And the next year, I played the whole season with the aggravation of a broken toe. This is 35. I led the league in stolen bases on that broken foot.
Wow.
And but it pained me the entire year. But that I had to have it operated on at the end of the 35 season. Dr. George Bennett of Hopkins Hospital operated on it.
Uh-huh.
At the end of the 1935 season. Subsequently, I had to have it operated on again, as he told me would be necessary. But this inhibited my ability to play up to the standard that I should have played, and really made me more certain to get out of baseball than I was originally.
Oh, yeah.
That's my fault, not baseball's.
Right.
But it was a good thing in a way, because it made me study and it made me work in the wintertime, and was a good thing on the whole. Now, let's get on to four.
Yes, sir.
1933, your first full major league season. The Yankees sold you to the Red Sox. How did you feel? I didn't feel too good about that. I went to spring training in 1933, and I played practically all of the games at shortstop for the Yankees in 1933. In those games, I fielded well, and I hit about 350. And did very well indeed. In the meantime, Thomas Yawkey had bought the Red Sox. They had a scout over with the Yankees by the name of McAllister that was over there trying to buy some players to supplement what they had at the Red Sox. And so the Yankees had two other shortstops, Corsetti and Larry. And when we broke spring training, McCarthy took me out of shortstop. We went to Birmingham or Memphis, and I don't remember which. But in any event, he put Corsetti in to play short. And Frank did a good job. He looked good, hit good. And then we moved to Birmingham or Memphis. I can't remember which cities we were playing, but we were coming north playing exhibition games. And Corsetti again looked good. And as a consequence, McCarthy ended up selling me to Boston and keeping Corsetti. And so I was very disappointed because I had the job. I felt I had the job sewed up. But that was all right. You take what comes out.
Yes.
But that's how I happened to get to Boston. At the same time, Boston also bought Dusty Cook, an outfielder, and George Pipgrass, a pitcher.
Right.
Now, number five. You played 37 and 38 with the A's. Then Connie Mack wouldn't give you a $1,500 raise and sold you to the Reds. At the end of the year, you gave the raise back to the Reds. Why? There's a very interesting story connected with this. When I was over with the Red Sox, Cronin had made a disparaging, vulgar remark about the Red Sox in 33. I called him on it. I'm a little bit edgy about people making comments that I'm supposed to overhear, perhaps. And when he came out of the dugout, I waited for him at third base, and I called him on it. And he said, "Oh, Bill, I didn't mean anything, just adding impetus to the troops or something like that." And anyhow, that was 33 when they won the pennant.
Mm-hmm.
So in 1934, when the season started, we opened in Washington. I got 4-for-4 on opening day, but in any event, I got after Cronin, and I stayed on him. I stayed on him the entire year of 1934 and made life pretty miserable for the fellow. And ultimately, when he came over in 35 to manage the Red Sox, I knew I would be traded, and I did get traded to Connie Mack. So I'm over with Connie Mack now, and Pinky Higgins is playing third for the Red Sox. Anyhow, I had a good year for Connie Mack and felt I was entitled to a minimum $1,500 raise and expected to get it. And Mr. Mack was obdurate about the whole matter, and the ball club went off to Lake Charles, Louisiana to train, and I was working out of my father's office and doing very well. I had enough money that I made during the wintertime to take care of myself and my family, And I was working out in the afternoons with the University of Maryland team. I lived right not too far up the University of Maryland campus. So, ultimately, Mr. Mack sold me to the Reds. And this is just before both teams were about to break training camp. This is, they're all through training camp, just about. They're going to break training camp. So the first I heard about the sale was from an AP man whom I knew. And he said, what are you going to do? And I said, well, I don't know. I haven't heard from either ball club. So then Warren Giles of the Reds called and said, we've acquired your contract from the A's. We'd like to have you show up in Tampa. And we'd like to talk to you. I said, just put the $1,500 in my contract and I'll show up. And they said, no, we can't do that because we don't pay as much money in the National League as they do in the American. And I said, well, Mr. Giles, I said, that's too bad because then I won't be there. And then there was a lot of exchange of polite conversation and he said, well, we are sorry, we'd like to have had you. And he hung up. And then came a call from Lake Charles, Louisiana, from Mr. Mack. Why don't you go over and play with the Cincinnati? I said, they don't want to pay me the $1,500 that you refused to give me. He said, well, make a deal for yourself. I said, I'm not interested in that. I'm your property. You make the deal. And then this goes on. He said, well, you go over there. He said, and I'll send you a check $1,500. I said, no, I don't want your $1,500. I want it in a raise from the Reds. I want it in their contract. Well, he said, you'll have to work that out with him. Goodbye. Goodbye, Mr. Mack. So then I get a call from Mr. Giles. He said, I can't do anything until Bill McKechnie gets in. Bill McKechnie's been over to Miami to play an exhibition game. This, that. So I said, fine. I said, call me when you make up your mind. He said, are you in shape to play ball? I said, yes, I'm in shape to play ball. And finally he called back and he said, come on down. We'll give you the $1,500. All right. At the end of the year, we won the pennant.
Yes, sir.
I think I've made a significant contribution to help them win the pennant.
No doubt.
So he calls me on the phone at my home in Cincinnati and says, Bill, he said, we've had a good year. He said, you've made a big contribution. He said, could you stop in the office tomorrow? I'd like to sign you up before you go home. I said, be delighted, Mr. Giles. And then I talked with Mrs. Werber and said, what do you think we ought to get from him? And we talked about it, and we decided what I was going to get. Now I get down to his office the next morning, and he said, what do you want to play for us next year? I said, Mr. Giles, I said, I don't know. I said, you know more what I'm entitled to than I do. What do you want to give me? And then he gave me a figure. And I said, well, now, Mr. Giles, I said, that's $1,500 more than I had intended to get out of you. I said, now, last year, I said, you didn't raise too much of a fuss about the $1,500 I wanted and gave it to me. So this year, I said, I'll give it back to you. So I gave it back to him, and he thanked me and took it.
Well,
about the $1,500 I gave back to him.
That's a great story. Let's digress just a minute. You talked about Joe Cronin.
Yeah.
I have talked with, over the last couple of years in interviewing, I've talked with some of your Red Sox teammates. I talked with, who did I talk with? Jack Wilson, pardon me?
Bobby Doerr?
No, didn't talk with don't talk with too many of the real big names. I like the hard-nosed ball players and some of the guys who maybe were a little unsung, and that's who I talked to. Jack Wilson?
He's a pitcher.
Yeah. Eldon Auker. Now, I guess you were in Philadelphia when Auker was there.
Eldon Auker did most of his pitching for Detroit.
Right, but he was with Boston 1 year. I talked with Gene DeSautels. These guys, and maybe I'm talking out of school and shouldn't, but they did not like Joe Cronin as a manager. What was your opinion of him?
I thought Joe was a good manager. He went out of his way to placate me. I found no fault with him at all. He was a good performer. He was a good battler. He was a good competitor. I'd rate Joe high on the list. I really would.
Okay, that's I like to get the opinions like that. Each person sees something in a different light.
I had no complaint over there at all.
Okay.
Well,
that's good. Okay, I'm glad to hear that because I was getting a little disillusioned about the man.
Yeah, no, he was okay. You know, in connection with my holdout, a funny thing happened up at the University of Maryland. It's an interesting story. It was interesting to me. I would get up to the University of Maryland. Burton Shipley, the coach, and Miriam, his wife, were friendly with Pat and myself, my wife. And I'd go up there and work out with the University of Maryland team, and they'd have games between the varsity and the scrubs. And I'd play third base for the scrubs, and I'd have on an old raggedy pair of khaki pants and a lousy-looking old moth-eaten sweatshirt. But the day that the varsity were issued their new uniforms, black caps and dark gray and gold uniforms, you know, they were handsome and all. They had a game, and I played third base for the scrubs. And that day I had about 3 for 4 and got an extra base on a single and stole a base and made some big league plays at third. And the next day in the newspaper, the sports writer that had been in the stands was highly critical of Burton Shipley, said that Chip never did know his ass from third base or something to that effect, because the best ball player on the field was the scrub that had his third. And said he couldn't figure out why they failed to issue me a uniform.
That's hilarious.
Yeah, I thought that they didn't check the names or the personnel or anything. He said, but the scrub playing third base is the best-looking ball player on the field. Well, let's get to 6.
Yes, sir.
The only significant difference between the Reds of 38 and the Reds of 39 was you. Should you have been the most valuable player? I don't think so. As I remember the 39 season, we had Walters winning about 27 games and Derringer winning about 25. I could be a little bit off on these things. Your memory isn't always as good as you think it is.
Right. Those are close, though. I'd have to look back, too, but that's pretty close.
I don't have my baseball encyclopedia in front of me, but it could have been Derringer winning 27 or Walters 25 or 26 and 24, something like that. But those two fellas won a hell of a mess of ball games. Well, when you have guys that are winning like that, and you have other fellows on the ball club like Junior Thompson and Jim Turner and Joe Beggs and John Vandermeer and Elmer Riddle and a real good staff that's coming in there and picking up slacks. You've got to give that pitching staff collectively more credit than any one individual. And then you got Frank McCormick at first base that wakes up from his somnambulism, and he drives in 125 or 130 runs or whatever he drives in. I don't remember that either. But he had a hell of a year.
Yes, sir.
And so these things are related to each other and hard to say, but it wouldn't have been me.
Okay. Well, I think that's very modest of you, but I'm not going to argue with you, but you and Junior Thompson were the only additions from the 38 team.
Yeah, well, I put something into them. I'll get to that down here a little later.
Okay.
Talk about the 39 and 40 World Series. Well, since the 39 World Series, it came before the 40 World Series, and we lost it, you naturally would be disinclined to talk about it as much as you would about the second series, which you won.
Of course.
It's always nicer to be the world champion.
Yes, sir.
But in 1939, we had too many key players that failed to bat the ball out of the infield.